Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Internet Marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Internet Marketing Podcast brought to you by Site Visibility. I'm here with Andreas Luizu. Andreas is a business storytelling specialist. I am interested, just as we introduce you, Andreas, to figure out how do you describe yourself to people?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Very brave and almost successful attempt at pronouncing my surname, which is Luizu. But no one's really got that right over the years. And that includes me, I believe. When I've spoken to other sort of native Greek Cypriots, they say I've got it all wrong and I'm using the wrong form and my dad was a liar. So that's a whole other story. So how do I describe myself? Well, it's kind of to understand where I am in writing, you know, what are the credentials for writing this book? You know, I suppose you have to go back really to school. So my big interests were always literature and economics. So at 18, I had to decide. And I chose, and I think I made the right decision, I chose to do English. You know, after my first degree, I was going to pursue a more academic career, but I was also interested in business. I thought I could do business first and then academia. I probably couldn't do it the other way around. So I had a big switch, and I joined PwC. I joined their management consultancy, the business advisory service. But at the same time, I qualified as a chartered accountant. So I was always quite strong on the mathematical side. So kind of from really my mid-20s onwards, these two sides, the business side and the writing side, came together. And I began to be the person that was asked to write reports or, you know, to write in those days memos and stuff like that. And that kind of continued, straddling both sides of that. As I worked, I worked as an investment analyst in the city. And I was good enough sort of financially, good enough with maths, but my real thing was the writing. I think that's what made me stand apart from other people working in those sorts of roles. So kind of scroll forward 10 years from that, I started to work in training, predominantly in financial training. So treat, you know, quite hard maths, things like company valuation or company analysis. But always with a focus on how you can explain this to other people through good, accurate writing. And over the years, I've introduced more and more writing techniques and more storytelling techniques into my courses until they actually became courses about business storytelling. Or to be really, really accurate, the courses were often about financial storytelling. So I worked basically with big banks and asset managers to get whatever message they wanted to get across to, for example, their shareholders who maybe weren't particularly financially literate. And that's just sort of developed since then. So I started to write more and more about financial things and about business. Then the opportunity came to write The Story Is Everything. Again, this is a lucky story that this came up a week after we went into lockdown. I'd been speaking about this book with a few companies. And then a company who knew me kind of approached me semi out of the blue and said, you know, we hear you're planning this. Would you like to write this? And the timing was great because I thought, oh, you know, COVID's here. We're going to have at least 2 weeks in lockdown. So I can do a really good kind of like outline of this book. I didn't, of course, none of us thought that the next 4, 5, 6 months would be inside. And if you flip it around, kind of that isolation and that lack of distraction, yeah, they're absolutely perfect conditions for writing. So I continued to teach. All my teaching moved online. Everybody was interested in storytelling. So it's really kind of joyful for me to be writing a book about what I was teaching at the time. And it makes it really fresh because I'm, you know, using examples. My clients, my teaching clients are from all around the world. So I am able to, you know, access examples that are different from other people telling you about storytelling or business writing. And I really set out to write a book that didn't have any mention of Apple. Obviously brilliant marketing techniques, but it's been so overdone. And I didn't want to talk about Star Wars as a story because that's been so overdone as well. So I was able to bring in these two sides in terms of content, the literary side and the business side, and the kind of the training side as well. And that's for me, that's what makes the book run. So it's very much about a practical guide. There's lots of examples, there's a fair bit of theory, but it's actually about you writing stories about your business.
And we're going to get into all of that in a minute. So you mentioned there, The Story Is Everything, Mastering Creative Communication for Business. That's your book, available everywhere you get good books. And it was published on April the 14th. So we're here just a few days after that.
Sure.
Is the feeling that you have now the book is published the feeling that you expected?
Well, I've published a couple of books in the past. It's a really, really strange feeling because I'm very, and this is about me rather than about books. This is how I always approach projects. I'm very, very project driven. So I've never worked for a long time for the same company. And I tend to put my heart and soul into a project. And then something like the book is really strange because you really go for it. And it's edited, it's re-edited, it's legally checked, you do final changes, and then it all goes silent for 6 months. You know, and then you get a book, you know, the postman turns up and suddenly you open it up thinking it's your, you know, it's kind of your new headphones or something, and actually it's 9 copies of this thing that you finished 6 months ago. And it's a really strange feeling because there's a little bit of a distance between what you've created and what's actually produced. So when I was writing the book, I'm a big over planner. So when I'm writing a book, I plan a lot, and I use bits of paper. I buy really big sketchbooks to draw mind maps. I use Excel. I use mind mapping software. I've got kind of post-it notes everywhere. And then that slowly reduces into a plan for the book, and then 20 chapters, and then kind of modules, or even down to the paragraph level. And then you start writing and everything changes. You know, I want my planning to be flexible. And it's like a big sort of like funnel, kind of all these ideas you have, you narrow them down into the writing. And then you've got, I think in this case, something like 38,000, 40,000 words. And then it comes out and it's kind of all your ideas are just in this one place that you can, like I've got a copy in front of me, you can pick up and drop on the desk in front of you. And it's a great, great feeling. There's something magical about producing a book, especially a book that's been edited by other people, because you know, unless you're very lucky, unlucky, it won't have any mistakes, it won't have any typos, and it'll be well written.
What do you do with all of those notes and post-its and all of that information that went into the book? Is that something that you keep? Do you throw it all away?
I keep all the computer stuff, definitely. Well, I can't throw it away. This is a terrible sort of retention thing. in my mind, in about 40 years, there'll be a museum to my greatness. And people, young students will look around and think, my God, that was the, you know. I had this with one of my teachers when I did my master's at Cambridge. She would say she'd go into libraries to study, and the librarians at the end of the day would say, can we keep your pencil because we want to put it in our museum? And I just thought, that's so bizarre. And I just always had this dream that someone somewhere will be interested in how I got there. So I throw most of it away, but the earliest ideas I try and keep this kind of what I call the storyboard, which is the chapter outline. Mm. And the real reason I do that is I think I learn a lot from planning. So I think a lot of us, when we're writing anything, stories or anything, we actually, because we're a little bit nervous, we're afraid of the clock, of the countdown, we probably start writing too early. So I really like the planning stage. I really like refining and learning about the planning stage. So I tend, after the book, so when Story Was Everything was finished, I did go back to my notes and my plans and my kind of sketches and think, right, you know, what could you do better next time? And I think that, you know, the key idea of this, if there's a learning for your listeners, is that plan, but keep your planning really flexible. You know, plan in a way that if you're midway through chapter three and a better idea comes to you, a smarter example, have space in your planning for that. Because the actual process of writing will always create more ideas.
Yeah, one of the reasons that I ask that question is because we live in a world where a lot of people document everything. So document the story of everything. And so it's really interesting in writing, because you have a decision to make as you're writing anything, particularly a book. Do you release that information out to the world in parts as part of the story of the book? Or do you keep it all in and just allow people to review the finished product? Where do you stand on the documentation of everything? So keeping those notes, keeping those post-its, did you use any of that in promotion of the book? Or is that stuff you like to keep for yourself?
Oh, God, that's such a complex question. Let me give you like the simple answer is I hate it. I basically hate it when writers are saying things like, oh, here's my Scrivener word count for the day.
Or,
it's, you know, here's the 19 titles I've rejected. Now, I understand why people do that. And I think the actual process of creation is really, really interesting. But I'm not interested in, unless I've bought the book, I'm not interested. So, for example, kind of my favorite author is George Orwell. And yeah, I will read early drafts, or he does very simple plans. And sometimes his essays become, you know, there's a process where if you read his really short essays or newspaper pieces, you can see how they become a nonfiction book in his mind. I think that's fascinating. But unless I'm actually invested in the final book, then it's of no import to me. And I think when you go onto Twitter or Instagram, I think a lot of new writers do this. And I think they're actually what they're, you know, because writing obviously is pretty much a solitary activity. So what they're looking for is someone to say, well done, you know, you've done the work, Cam. And that's absolutely fine, but it doesn't kind of interest me at all. Whereas I love people who've had a book out and then 5 years later say, oh, I would have changed everything because of this and that and that. And I love that, that kind of, I like the finished article, the finished product, and then going back to it. I love the way how, you know, there's a really great saying about, that's either come from the ancient Greeks or from Zen philosophy, or probably from a lot of different sources, about you can never step in the same river twice. And that's what I'm saying, like, the river changes, but also you change so much. And I think it's got a really big application with reading books, but also with writing books. You write a book and you read it 5 years later and it feels so different. The book stayed exactly the same. You have changed. And I think that's a much more interesting thing to investigate than, you know, here are my four plans for the cover that my brother-in-law has knocked up on Canva.
Your process for storytelling is something, the enthusiasm for the process is something that actually comes across in the book and is also reinforced now as you're talking to me. It's interesting because in the book you touch on a part where you're talking about data analysts, almost two data analysts.
Yeah.
You explain left brain dominant people versus right brain dominant people and how they can communicate, or how you can communicate in your own brain to other people. And you seem to have kind of this hybrid nature, this hybrid approach to creativity and business. You've got you're right in the middle, left brain and right brain. Do you find many people like you?
I think everybody's like that. I think we have predominances that, you know, it's an interesting question. Are you quote unquote artistic because you're born artistic or because your parents were artists? And I think a lot of it is about how you grow up. And I think it's very, very limiting to look at the brain as two spheres that don't connect. I think the actual research, I looked into this because, you know, I was always hearing this left brain, right brain stuff.
Yeah.
I looked into it, and actually the original research into this was designed to show that the hemispheres are connected, that they're not separate. What we've done is and what we continue to do at a really early age and say things like, oh, he'll never be able to do maths because he likes playing the trumpet. Or they're really good at drawing, which means they'll be rubbish at physics. And you see that, like, you go later on into work, especially now I begin to, you know, I run a festival. I meet lots of people who are involved in arts management. And they often say, well, you know, I'm managing this, but I still can't do a cash flow because I'm artistic. And you know what? I think that's a bit of an excuse. I think that's easy. I believe that everything is learnable. And as a consequence of that, I believe everything is teachable. And, you know, my natural, you know, template or the way I see the world would stop me from being, say, a biologist, right? That's not how I think, but I would love to find out what a biologist is. There are so many restrictions already placed on us. Why would we do this kind of not particularly true form of kind of a neuro restriction? I think I may have coined a new word there, neuro restrictive.
I like it.
When we've got influences from all sides, you know?
Yeah, one of the reasons I asked the question, it's a question that's personal to me, because if you were to describe me as a marketer, I'd be a hybrid marketer. I'm equally comfortable and enthusiastic in data and analysis as I am in copywriting. I love them both. And I've always felt this maybe either pressure, and it could be pressure on myself, to kind of choose a discipline, to choose a specialism in marketing. Yeah. And that was maybe earlier on, in particularly when I started out in marketing, but these days I'm much more comfortable in being a generalist. And it's something that you just talked about it there. I love how a wider fascination with marketing and creativity opens my mind up. And I don't feel that pressure to pigeonhole myself really as a specialist marketer. And I was interested in your journey, whether you've experienced that same kind of either pressure that you've put on yourself or a decision at some point in your career where you thought, oh, maybe I really need to throw myself into a creative discipline, because it's something that exists. You feel it sometimes.
It's the opposite, actually. I felt I needed, and it sort of certainly financially, I needed to get a job. Mm-hmm. And I didn't come from a background where I could spend 4 or 5 years writing a novel, and, you know, I've got an auntie who's a literary agent that's going to sell it to Penguin. That's not my background at all. So I had to make money. And as I said, I was interested in business. I liked going into different businesses and seeing how they work. So if anything, it was more that I got later on, and I thought, well, you know, actually, when are you going to write these novels? When are you going to write these books? And I got onto the Faber and Faber Novel Writing Academy the first time that was run. And it was great because you meet loads of people who, you know, did English, wanted to be novelists, and then their first job was X, and then they moved. They really liked X, or they had a mortgage, and then they moved into Y. And then Z and W, and you kind of like each move takes you perhaps further away from where initially you were aiming at. But I do think that, say, I read relatively few novels by people in their 20s. I read a lot more about people that have worked, that have struggled in different spheres, and then have got to 50 or 60 or even 70 and thought, right, I'm going to write that novel. I think you can perhaps be too early with your kind of with the quest for publication. And, you know, I take my hat off to anybody that gets published. It's a really, really hard process. But, you know, I want to draw a distinction for your listeners. I think getting published is an amazing thing that happens to you, and it just feels really great. But 99% of writers don't get published. And I actually think that's what makes writing great, that you can do it for yourself, you know, or you can do it for a really limited audience, and it's still completely valid.
This is interesting. It also leads me into a question that I wanted to ask coming into this. And it's about current society allows us, it allows us, because we can self-publish, we can publish everything, as we discussed before. And so maybe that reduces the quality of some writing potentially, or perhaps people are publishing too early, as you described. The message that I got from your book is you study storytelling and you've studied it for a long time. I took your book as almost like a dissection of storytelling. That's how it came across to me. Yeah. And I'm interested in that study of storytelling. What has changed for you over, has anything changed over the period that you've been studying storytelling in comparison to how it is today?
Yeah, what's changed is, you know, obviously you and I were talking about storytelling as part of marketing.
Yeah.
The actual reasons for telling stories hasn't changed one bit. The way a good story is constructed is the same now as it was. Yeah, people tend to sort of always invent these examples of cavemen telling stories around the fire. We don't know they did that. No one was there. No one was there to record that. We're just assuming. But we know in kind of ancient Greece, in China, in Rome, certainly, that stories existed, that people communicated tales. I think the basics are the basics. And the basics are, what do people want? They want an emotional connection with a character. They want a story that has an element of struggle and achievement and attainment. Most of us prefer a happy ending. Yeah, we all like stories that are polished. And this is where perhaps you're hinting at things like self-published books. I've got to say, I don't read self-published books in the same way that you will never ever buy a ticket to hear me play guitar. Right, I love playing guitar. I play guitar as a crime against music. Right, I'm happy to play guitar on my own in my room with my daughter, sort of holding her hands over her ears. But I think some things aren't meant for like wider distribution. You think about the commitment as a reader you make with a book. To read a book like mine is probably going to take you sort of somewhere between 12 and 24 hours. That's actually quite a lot of time that you're demanding from a reader. Readers are busy, they're easily distracted. None of us are asking for what we read to be made more complex or longer. You have a duty of care towards your reader, and that must involve editing and checking. And I've got to be really directive here. If you're going to get published, you must have someone else look at your work before you get published. I'm talking about books here. This, to me, will also apply to press articles. It certainly applies to press releases. You know, and it's not just catching spelling or errors and kind of like typos and punctuation mistakes. Those things are really, really important. It's about, can someone tell you a better idea? Can someone change the order for you so it has more impact? And if I slightly refine what I said about 10, 15 minutes ago, writing is a solitary practice, but publication is a team effort.
Yeah, you touch on this in the book, and I don't know if this explicitly applies to just book writing, but you touch, I think it might be, you talk about proofread, like finding a proofreading buddy. Is that how you describe it? You'll remember. And I am interested in that. Do you think that does apply to the storytelling in business, for example, checking of presentations as well as it might in terms of authoring books?
Yeah, without a doubt. Difference is, we're all good at presentations now because we've all, you know, many of us at university or even at school. Like my daughter, who's 12, does presentations. She knows how to use PowerPoint and stuff like that. She knows how to talk in front of a room. Presentations we're all good at. Writing, we're not all that good at, because writing, we can write a shopping list, but it's not the same as writing a story. And writing is probably, for most people, it's their 12th skill, or it's their 15th skill on their list. And that's why people are often nervous when it comes to writing. So what I suggest, the idea of a feedback buddy basically works like this. You choose someone who actually isn't a close friend. That's really important. It's not a mate. It's someone you know, and you offer. And you basically say, look, if I send you 500 words on this, or I send you this press release or this website text, can you look at it? And I'll do the same for you. And what happens is, it's kind of giving feedback is a really strange process because we're nervous, we don't want to upset people. But like, if there's anybody kind of like listening to this and they've got a piece of paper and a pen, just write kind of, this is one of the mistakes I very nearly made. The pen is mightier than the sword. I missed a space towards the beginning of that quotation between pen and is, if you're a bit slow thinking. And that very, very, very nearly got published. And it's only because of feedback. But I said, are you sure about this? And I thought, oh, Jesus Christ. You know, that would have been an absolute disaster. So you're basically, your feedback buddy is stopping you from like walking around with your flies open sort of thing, or saying, or having gravy on your shirt. And what happens is, when you start to swap, you're very respectful and polite, and then after a while that politeness goes and you'll just sort of say, no, change this is a bit rubbish, unclear, throw this on the fire, you don't need it. And the way in which you give feedback improves very, very quickly. So you could just, I've got someone, in fact, after this, I've got a call with a friend of mine called Weeda, who I've been swapping work with for 12, 15 years. And she'll just say, this is, you know, she won't even say this is rubbish. She'll use a shorter word if a paragraph doesn't make sense. And I know straight away, I'm now in that sort of situation, I've hardened up. I have no fear of feedback whatsoever. I actively welcome people pointing out my mistakes and giving me ideas that improve my work. I think that's a sign. If you feel in yourself that you react badly to feedback, that you think, oh, it's because they're a bad person or they don't understand, then look back at yourself and think, is that really the case, or am I just hypersensitive here?
There are lots of great tips in your book about, I guess, principles for giving and receiving feedback. Yeah. I am just on that topic of finding a feedback buddy, though. How would you recommend people find their buddy? Should it be a close friend or family member? Is that something to avoid?
Oh, avoid that. What's your mum going to say about your writing? She's going to love. The most dangerous sort of feedback is when someone writes back to you and says, oh, don't change a thing. That means, A, they're either in love with you for whatever reason, think you're perfect, or B, they haven't bothered to look at it, right? Never accept that feedback. I think you've got to look for someone. What I do is I imagine someone that I really sort of imagine her seeing someone I know who has very high standards, is intelligent, but doesn't know anything about the subject. Yeah. So I'm not setting myself up to be challenged by a content expert. I'm looking at someone who's going to evaluate my writing, my clarity, my accuracy, my precision. And basically, one of the other tips I give is aligned to this, is that I read out. So before I send anything out, I read it out loud, because that's when you can really hear your mistakes and you can tell where your punctuation has gone bad. And I just imagine myself reading to her. And if she looks bored, or if she looks puzzled, or if she gets up from that imaginary chair, I know that it's not good enough. I know I've got to work harder. So, and that's before I send it out to a real person. So you'll find, if you actively look for people, you will find other people who are willing to swap. And it has to be a swap. It has to be a system or where you share, where you offer as well as you receive feedback. And that's what makes it really work. If it's just one-sided, that person is eventually going to say, nah, I can't be bothered. Or they may be a professional editor. If you work for a big company, you may have a professional editor who's just going to see 100 different bits of text every day and just wants to get rid of you. You know, in the nicest possible way, they'll clean up your errors, but they won't tell you what mistakes you're making. So we always think about feedback as something, I need this check so I can get it out now. But we should stop. We should get stuff out now. That's great. But we should also look at feedback as a learning opportunity. So if someone says, you know, you use a lot of passive tenses, or, you know, your sentence length becomes quite monotonous. These are long-term learning points. This is more than just getting that email out, getting that tweet out before coffee break. These are things that are going to change your writing style like forever. So you need to invest in that, because as I said, most of us, when we're at business, we don't get taught how to write.
When I was reading this aspect of your book and you talking through it now, the lazy marketer in me is saying, there's got to be an app for this. Like, imagine an app where you try and find someone that's not part of your field, your genre, and they provide feedback on your work and you provide feedback on theirs, like a mutual feedback society type app. But that is the lazy marketer. I'm sure you can find these people in other areas of life without an app. Does that sound like a good idea or a bad idea?
I think there are apps like that out there, yeah, in the creative world. In the marketing world, I've not come across anything. My old school approach to this would be, it's probably better to have someone that you could you already know and whose work you respect and whose level is kind of slightly better than yours.
Yeah,
I think there's a risk. It's a bit like things like Google Translate, is that if you put that in, say I speak Spanish, so I put some Spanish text I've written, it comes out in English and it's almost correct. Whereas if I'd gone for a coffee with a Spanish mate, I can get it 100% correct.
Yeah,
I think that's a big difference. It's like when you're on YouTube and they've done a commentary and they've used one of those apps that provides the commentary, and there's absolutely no intonation, there's no difference in the voice. You know, he has died today of cancer, like that. Yeah. And it's, you think, what on earth has made you lose your personality, lose your own tone of voice for this computer? You know, I think if your English isn't perfect, or your language isn't perfect, but you're making it's good enough and you're making a real effort, I think that's quite compelling. Because anybody that's ever done anything in a second language will just know how hard it is. And I've got tremendous respect for what you think about in the UK, especially how many people you meet who are doing incredibly complicated marketing jobs or any sorts of jobs in a second language.
Yeah, it's incredible.
That's a big thing.
Oh, as you were talking about feedback, you were talking about people that are maybe in this, they've got this thirst to release information quickly to the world, whether it's a tweet or an article. And in the book, you touched on people being their own proofreaders, their own self-editing,
yeah,
because of this demand. Is that something that's changed in your study of storytelling, this thirst for getting things out quickly?
Yeah, I think the whole speed has changed.
Yeah.
Not just of writing. You know what's caused the increase in speed of writing? It's the increase in speed of reading. So if you look at I got some stats from the a surprisingly good source, is the UK government website. And they estimate that if you have a web page, even on a subject you like, you're only going to read 20 to 28% of the words on it. You know, okay. Normally it's a bit like a conversation. If you're hard of hearing, if you hear 8 out of 10 words, you'll be okay normally. So we just speeded that up when we skim. And what that means is, or one of the many impacts of that, is that people are less careful when they write, just because of the time pressures, and also the errors that people make are less, at a certain level, are less noticeable. So you may not notice. So something like 30 years ago was 100% correct, something like the BBC News website. You'll see typos and spelling errors quite frequently on that now. You know, 30 years ago, if someone has used the word incorrectly on a BBC kind of news report, the Telegraph and the Times would be full of letters tomorrow complaining about the breakdown of civilization. Hmm. We read much more rapidly and we care a little bit less, or we think we care a little bit less about what's presented. In fact, I think the opposite is true. I think the really clever marketing people have realized that people now skim in a very, very distinct way. And also they realize that how we read online is changing, or has changed, how we read offline. So a simple thing, I'm writing the follow-up to Stories Everything at the moment. I've been looking at headlines, and it seems that the most effective length for a headline is just 6 words. Okay, so we start with that. Then the second piece of information is, people who skim tend to read the first 3 words or the last 3 words of a headline or of a sentence before they make the decision to carry on. So you've got here, if you like, you've got two proofs that you've got 6 words to get interest. So you can't do kind of like the equivalent of throat clearing online. You can't do, when you see all these kind of this email list to tell you about this, that's just a waste of time. By the time they've got to, the reader's got to the end of that sentence, they've cast you off. Yeah, here's a tweet about no, stop it, just go straight to it. And actually, going straight to it is a real skill. You know, it quick and easy. So if something is quick and easy to read, it's because someone has spent a lot of time crafting it.
And in your book, you touch on techniques to help with what I'm going to describe as brevity or succinctness in writing.
Yeah.
I'm so curious about this particular topic because I love copywriting as well. And so I love this craft of making something that's really engaging in the fewest words possible. But something that sticks with me is I think about, as you touch on in the book, long form content and wider vocabularies and the people that like to be maybe more flamboyant with their writing. And I wonder, is there still a place for that in today's society? Where do you think that's going in the future?
Well, the place for that, Scott, is in your question, because you used a word that I immediately thought, what? What's Scott Coleman using the word succinctness for? That's not a word that suits you. I don't know you that well, but that's not a word you'd ever use. Would you use that word to your mates?
I use it a lot, actually.
Do you? Well, yeah, I'm not judging. But stop using it, Scott. Stop using it. No, see, what you have in English, and this is one of the great things about the English language, is this what people politely call borrowing, or we may call theft now, of different parts of speech, different words from many different languages. So what you always have, or what you usually have in England, in English, American English, Australian English, whatever it's, wherever it's based, is you have the ability to say something as if you'd come, as if you were working in a church in the Latin ages, so you would say succinctness, or if you're Anglo-Saxon, kind of some sort of Anglo-Saxon peasant. So there's always a short form, which is one or two syllables. So let me think of an example. I could use the more Latinate word receive, or I could use get. Mm-hmm. They both have the same meaning. They're both semantic. The semantics are the same. But the impression those sorts of words give are very, very different. Now, the thing is, if you use a lot of the Anglo-Saxon words, people say, oh, it's a bit sort of poor. It's a bit, you know, like at school, I grew up in Margate, which was by no means a rich place then, right? But I was told not to use words like get because it was, you know, it was seen as lower class.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I would meet loads of people, especially when I started work, not so much at university, but when I started work, I would use people that instead of saying give money, they would say administer funds. Okay, and I've always been very wary. Not wary, that's not true. I've been very alert. If people talk like that and that's their natural voice, that's fine. But I'm always wary when someone has started off with shorter words and for some reason moves to longer words. Because normally you think the friendlier or closer you get to someone, the more you would go from the long to the short. If you ever see the other move, it's a sign normally for me that that person is trying to become pompous for some sort of reason with their vocabulary. Perhaps they feel that they're threatened by the conversation, or they feel a need to somehow kind of, it's almost like people playing like linguistic top trumps. They're trying to say, you know, a word. Oh God, you know, I didn't know the word quintessence, for example. And to me, that's always nice. That's the opposite of skilled communication.
Yeah.
That's making things harder. So I would always say, if you're given the choice and it's not going to offend people in your marketing speech, use the Anglo-Saxon, use the shorter word. You know, a simple thing is it takes up a lot less space. We're all looking to increase our readability. So the less space you use with words, you know, the more space you open up for another word.
And do you consciously apply this when writing your books now as well? Is it something the writing in, I guess, more short form or writing with brevity, is that something that you're very conscious of? Has your writing changed to encompass this over the years?
Yes. The writing style in this book, it's interesting because this book is based on a series of courses and lectures that I deliver to clients, to business clients, and also to MBA students at universities pretty much around the world. And so it's honed, you know, with lots of spoken practice. So when I came to write, I would say at least half of the book, I was able almost to dictate to myself, you know, and I would have worked this in such a way that on my courses are brutal. If you're wasting time with courses as a tutor, people switch off, they get their phones out. So you've got to think of like really quick and efficient ways to get your message across. And also you've got to keep changing because people's attention spans have become really, really short. So the course gave me, if you like, the voice and part of the structure for the book as well. I deliberately went for a tone of voice that was conversational. I didn't want this to be someone lecturing, you know, talking down to people. I don't think that's how people choose to learn. And also it's not, you know, occasionally I do, you know, very occasionally, like once a year I have to do a formal lecture. It's a different voice. It's a different tone of voice and it fits that environment. But that's not how I choose to communicate. And I think the vast majority of your listeners, if they're involved in marketing, they're looking for a way that's quick, but also that's personable, that creates some sort of connection with the listener or the reader. And that means really thinking about vocabulary. I'll give you just another example I was talking about this morning is just someone, you know, just like they didn't have time. We've got a bit of a rush job going on, and I said, how's it going? And they said, well, at this moment in time we've got this. And I didn't want to say, what, when you say at this moment in time, do you mean now? Yeah, you do, don't you? I didn't say it because he's stressed. Okay, but it's things like that, and these are really simple things, if you're attuned to them, that automatically improve the quality of your writing. And if your writing's good, then your storytelling follows. You know, you don't get storytellers who are great storytellers and bad writers. It just doesn't go together.
And in closing, Andreas, I'm interested just on this topic of the skills that you're teaching people and the skills and techniques that are included in your book that people can learn. What I thought about is I looked at the book and I thought there's a lot of information here. And how you can read it, and I feel like it's a book that you have to apply, and you have to apply the techniques over a period of time. You can't just read the book and then immediately, well, there are some techniques that will make you an immediately a better storyteller, but it comes with practice. What are your recommendations for people taking the techniques from your book and applying them? How do they do that?
Well, the key word is practice. You know, it's kind of what yogics say, you know, with practice comes everything. You cannot expect, you know, this is one of the big problems with a lot of the business storytelling books I've read in the past. So they'll say, God, in Jaws, everybody's really, really afraid of the shark, even though you don't see the shark until kind of two thirds of the way into the movie. And then they'll jump a paragraph and they'll say, try and get the shark into your marketing copy. Right. And to me, that's useless advice. Absolutely stupid, because you haven't explained how. So I go through in the book just like really simple, like three line stories that anyone can do. You've all heard. I think one of the things, if you're working for not a one man band, but if you're working for a small, medium, or especially in a big company, listen out this week. Listen out for the stories about, do you remember Reg and how he sold all those bananas? Or do you remember Susan and how she changed this and how this happened and that happened? Companies are run on stories, you know. You just got to be aware of them. You just got to be alert to them. And these become the urban myths of companies. And then they glue the whole companies together in certain ways. And you actually want to be the person that something great happened to you and you turned it into a story. And what I love is, like, I've done this in the past when I've been at companies. Someone quotes back one of the stories I've told to me. And someone says, do you hear there was this guy that wrote this really good book about called The Story Is Nothing or something like that? Because I always get a little bit wrong. And I think that's great because you've added something, you know, into the world. And I think, you know, something for your listeners to aim for. And this is kind of the world of advertising, which is slightly different, which is clearly different. But if you could ever do the equivalent of have a break, have a Kit Kat, or go to work on an egg, you know, little slogans like this, they're stories in themselves. They just stick with people forever.
Andreas, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. The book, again, for anyone that's interested, is The Story is Everything, Marketing Creative Communication for Business by Andreas Luizou.
Just remember, The Story is Everything and Andreas.
Story is Everything. And you can get the book on Amazon. Andreas, before we close, do you want to let our listeners know where they can find out more about you? The Story is Everything, and maybe if they want to extend the conversation with you, where can they find you?
Yeah, the best way to get a hold of me is if you want to talk about books and writing, then I would say LinkedIn is a really good thing. I also, something we didn't touch on, which is I also run something called the Margate Bookie, which is a charity that encourages reading and writing. And you can follow that, or you follow us, I suppose is a better word, on Twitter. I'm very interested in this whole idea of literature and stories just making our lives better. So I'm very happy to hear from anyone, pretty much about anything.
Wonderful. All of the links to anything that we've discussed today will be in the show notes. And for now, all I'll say is, Andreas, thanks so much for your time. This has been the Internet Marketing Podcast. Take care.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.